Hey folks, welcome to episode 20 of the Brief Encounter podcast with me, Johnny Boyle. On this episode, I'm delighted to announce my guest is Irish actress Brona Gallagher. Where do you start with Brona? She's been in so many things. It was so difficult to choose certain movies she's been in, having acted in movies like Pulp Fiction, Star Wars, Last Chance Harvey, The Commitments, Sherlock Holmes, Mary Riley, The Personal History of David Copperfield, and many, many others. Too many to mention. She's done lots of TV work as well. You'll find, you know, Brona could show up in an episode of Poirot or on a comedy show like The Peter Serafinovich Show. She's worked with just epic directors such as Alan Parker, Quentin Tarantino, Stephen Frears, Guy Ritchie, to name, but and Armando Iannucci of Alan Partridge fame. And gosh, he's made some incredible stuff, such as The Death of Stalin, as well as numerous TV shows. And, you know, it was just a joy really to catch up with Brona, as this was supposed to happen in February of 2020, and due to lockdown, we had to postpone it. Brona's just finished up filming season 3 of Brassic for Sky. She's also had a starring role in her own film, A Bump Along the Way, which was released by Element Pictures in 2019. I only watched the movie recently, and I'd highly recommend it. It's great to see her in a starring role. And it's great to see Derry coming to the forefront of cinema and TV, particularly with movies of this nature and the TV show Derry Girls. As mentioned, I lived there about 20 years of age for a couple of years, and it's a city that's very close to my heart. So we talk about Derry, we talk about her movie career, we talk about, you know, her 3 solo records, starting with Precious Soul in 2004, her self-titled album in 2012, and most recently, Gather Your Greatness. I remember Brona introducing me to Brian Eno in London many years ago, and we've had some great nights out together with all our friends, such as The Frames, and, you know, and Brona just has this glow about her. You know, she's just so much fun to be around, has just projects such a positive vibe, and she's really, really good at what she does. You know, and I remember actually she read her lines to me from Star Wars movie The Phantom Menace, which she appeared in. Actually, I think she appears in the opening scene and then gets blown up within the first 5 minutes. Spoiler alert there, folks, sorry about that. But she also appeared in that iconic scene in Pulp Fiction where John Travolta has to administer the shot of adrenaline to Uma Thurman, which is just one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've ever witnessed in cinema. So, you know, we just caught up and talked about lots of stuff, and it was just a catch-up. And I'm a huge admirer of Brona's work and her work as a singer as well. Funnily enough, we got at some point to start talking about the Beatles, and, you know, all roads generally lead to the Beatles. And when I finished this podcast with Brona, she sent me a clip playing drums and singing in Ringo's Corner in Abbey Road, which was a really, really nice thing for her to send me. So, guys, I hope you enjoy this chat. It's so hard to fit in somebody's career, which just has so much in it, into an hour and a half. But it was a really, really enjoyable conversation regardless. And I just want to thank John and Matt over at the Undetermined Podcast for editing this for me. I was a guest on their show a while back, and I think their podcast is excellent. They have a lovely, relaxed nature in how they deal with their guests. You know, and it's nice to connect with other podcasters and share some ideas. You know, and they've been massively helpful to me. So, you know, just want to send a shout out to those guys. And I just want to say, hope you enjoy this podcast. Coming up on my next episode, episode 21, I will have Paige Hamilton from Helmet and David Bowie fame. So, guys, take care, and I hope you enjoy this. All the best. Cheers. You know, I try to capture as much as I can. Who's Jesse Collins? I know that name.
Do you remember Jesse Collins is the lovely, she was a singer with Layla, her and her sister Layla and Jesse.
Yeah,
you played in their band, I think, way back
Jesus,
in the day.
I did. I haven't seen those girls in nearly 25 years. I was in their band for a little while. I think we did some gigs. I was maybe like 21, maybe 22 years old. You know,
easy. Fuck's sake. We're not spring chickens anymore. Hey, now, is this signal okay? Because I'm in the room with the fire lit, not the one that has the router. So you just let me know that the signal's all right.
It sounds great, Rona. I'm always on edge doing these things because I'm always afraid like the Wi-Fi will drop or something will happen. Or what I do is I just record it on my phone at the same time. So, but great, should be fine. It should be fine. I mean, fingers crossed. You know.
My love.
I was actually watching A Bump Along the Way today. I'm just over an hour into it, and it was on my watch list for ages and ages. And did your sister produce that?
Louise produced it. She started basically her role as a sort of solo producer, and are we recording now? Yeah. Okay, great. I'll say that again then. So Louise started her own independent company as a producer, and she approached NI Screen to basically avail of funding for first-time writers, first-time directors, and first-time producers, which was a category that they basically had come up with, which was brilliant, just to give young filmmakers across the board opportunities to make film and shorts. And Louise was sent the work of Tess McGowan, who was our writer, and Shelley, who was our director, Shelley Love, which is such a great name. And they got the three of them together, and Louise basically started the production on A Bump Along the Way. And then she sent me the script, and I thought it was beautiful. And then I became involved as well. I mean, I wasn't really supposed to ever play the lead role, but it just sort of all turned out that way. So yeah, Louise's first production as a producer, executive, produced by Roma Downey from Derry also. So it was about sort of a Derry-led women's triumph. Yeah. You know, it went from Tess McGowan is from Derry also. It went from a tiny wee low-budget film to entering in the Toronto Film Festival, Boston, we won the Galway Festival. You know, the list of accolades it had achieved is kind of incredible. So, yeah, really special, special project.
And it must have been, it must have been really just bittersweet for you to come back and play a lead role in a film shot in Derry. You know, that must have felt great.
Oh, we did the whole thing in Derry, absolutely, and in 18 days. So, you know, that was kind of incredible to have, number one, majority of the crew from Derry, and, you know, a lot of really skilled young people that have now obviously got involved in the great film industry that is in the north of Ireland as well. So it was brilliant. No, we had a great time. Mark McCauley, our DOP, was from Derry as well. So it was brilliant, you know, and we had filmed. Basically, Louise and I sort of objective doing it was to involve the whole community. So we shot it in a school on the waterside, Lisneal College, and that was a big deal for us to unite people from all kids from all areas of the community in Derry. And, you know, it was really, really special event and opened up a lot of relationships from the sort of artistic community to unite people in that way, which to us is kind of a bonus if you can do that in your work, you know. So, no, very special. Very special job, and as I say, it went on just to win accolade after accolade. So it's you know, it couldn't have went any better, really. When I said to Louise, you know, when you look back at what we thought we were going to achieve and what we did, it's kind of mind blowing, really. You know, we just sort of thought, oh, we'll shoot it in 18 days, see what happens, you know. So as a result of then Louise, and not just Bump Along the Way, but a result of that being on the sort of on her heels, Louise became the head of development for Hat Trick Productions in Belfast. And the Hat Trick have Derry Girls in their arsenal as well. You know, so
that is amazing. It's amazing. Well, it's great to see Derry being put on the map in, you know, in a cinematic way and also on TV. And, you know, it's funny actually because you mentioned the waterside, and I lived up in Kilfenan in like 94, you know. Yeah,
that's right.
And you know, for me, it's always a city. I just, you know, I spent you know, those formative years when you're really young and you just randomly go to a place in the hope of, you know, we had a singer from Derry and I just ended up staying a lot longer than I anticipated. And it was a wonderful experience, you know, it really was. I was actually, funnily enough, I remember I was sitting in watching TV one night up in the waterside, and I saw you in a movie. Was it Dear Sarah was your first film, right?
Right. Dear Sarah was the first film. I mean, I did a wee job before that with Michael Winterbottom, a wee drama when I was sort of 17 about kids from Derry meeting kids from Donegal. Right. And it was like a little educational program for kids to sort of learn to basically accept people from different ethnics, different ethnic backgrounds, different, you know, just kids that spoke differently or looked differently. So I think it was like a sort of a positive drama to help, you know, just develop kids' acceptance of other kids. And then from that, I got the sort of recognition of the Hubbards in Dublin, and the Hubbards cast Dear Sarah, yes, which was about the Guildford Four, obviously, and the carriage, miscarriage of injustice there for that family, and the Maguires. So, yeah, we did that in Dublin, actually, in 1989.
Right, it was shot in Dublin, okay.
Shot in Dublin, because, I mean, at that time, you couldn't shoot things in the north of Ireland, really. I mean, any dramas we did in Northern Ireland or based in Northern Ireland right up until sort of like 20 years ago were shot in Ireland, or Dublin.
Because, I was talking to Mark Geary, the singer-songwriter, about, you know, the whole idea of, like, if you weren't into, like, classical music, or, you know, if you wanted to kind of get into, like, rock music or even acting as well, or, you know, there was always that thing of having notions, I think, back in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? Was it, I suppose, when you were young, was it supported? Was the kind of art supported, or were you encouraged in that way, or was there an element of, you know, you're a dreamer, I suppose? Because I used to get a lot of crap when I was a kid, do you know what I mean?
I mean, I do think it's definitely, you know, these situations can either, you know, become buoyant or fall through the cracks in the floor if you don't have the right people around you encouraging you. And, you know, I think when you hear about musicians and actors or artists of any sort of caliber talking about a one individual that was, you know, inspiring to them, or basically give them what to me is one of the keys of life, which is confidence. And a certain individual in your music, you know, lessons, or, you know, one particular teacher recognized or seen a spark in you that they thought was worth encouraging. So I think I had that in school, but I also had it from my parents, who were very realistic. You know, we grew up obviously in the bog side, and, you know, there was very little opportunity for young people there to become actors, or, you know, more in the musician sort of element. You definitely had bands, you know, making names for themselves, you know, on the sort of global stage, big time, but very few. But, you know, and classical singers were always something that, you know, was very celebrated in Derry, and musicians and stuff like that. But, I mean, becoming an actress was definitely something that, you know, people raised an eyebrow at, and how realistic is that? But my parents were very, very open, and my parents are real music fans. You know, they're that's what they were growing up, always just mods that loved soul, and they were just two wee groovers. And, you know, they just were very, they were very supportive of us. And I think, you know, my mother had me sort of trained on as a hairdresser as well, because that's what my mommy did most of our sort of adult life. And, you know, but I was just one of those kids that had a passion for it. As you say, I was very much a dreamer, never really gave much attention to my sort of academic work. Loved art, you know, still love art, obviously, creating, making things. But I was just, you know, very lucky, Johnny, that I got the break that I did at 16, 17, you know.
Well, it certainly, I mean, the commitments obviously was the big entrance into the big world of movies, I suppose. And, you know, God bless Alan Parker, you know.
God bless, absolutely. God have mercy on him. And the Hubbards as well, you know, who took a real gamble, giving me sort of, you know, time after the initial sort of tapings with Alan. Just, you know, they said, but she speaks with a very strong Derry accent, but get her into the room and see, you know, can I sort of convince him that that wasn't going to be an issue? You know, do you actually have a sort of north side Dublin accent? So that was, you know, Roz and John, really, that that sort of fought to get me in there, and obviously Dara O'Malley as well, who was my agent at the time.
Yeah.
Very experienced. Was there like
I've done a bit of research, Brona, and the Oak Grove Theatre Group, was that something you were part of as a teenager? Yeah.
Tony O'Donnell and Derry. I mean, you know, this is the sort of, you know, this is the early 80s in the north, you know, really devastating time, and the hunger strikes, you know, were happening, and there were very serious troubles in the streets and stuff. And the Oak Grove, you know, Amateur Dramatic Society, basically were, you know, putting on annual pantomimes or summer shows, whatever, this lovely man, Tony O'Donnell, and, you know, the most incredible group of musicians. And when I look back now at the sort of the array of talent and the level of talent of people that were the musical directors, and people just did this, you know, for the crack and for something to do. And they were incredible, you know, given a sort of break in any professional arena, they would have done really well, but those opportunities just weren't there back then. But I mean, no, that was very much my training as a kid. And then, you know, Tony O'Donnell, it was Cora King, my gorgeous drama teacher in school, Miss Hunt, our music teacher, who was Beatles mad. You know, she used to teach us about the Beatles. That blew my mind. I mean, Mum and Dad had Beatles records, you know, and obviously that was your kind of beginning of understanding, you know, what a rock and roll band was. And then Tony, you know, basically then they were doing the pantomimes every year, the musicals, and then a lovely lady came to Derry called Susan McMullen, and Susan was a ballet teacher. So that's when you started I studied dance with her, and, you know, she used to bring, I think her husband got a transfer from the bank from Bangor or Belfast up to Derry, and she came with them and their young children, and she opened a ballet school up in Derry. So that was, like, that was serious stuff, you know, to have, you know, so little opportunity for children in Derry to do anything other than Irish dancing.
You know, and was there, I mean, back then as well, was there a thing of having to kind of stay in the house a lot as well? You weren't out in the streets a lot, or my understanding back then, it was kind of a lot of, everyone was kind of behind closed doors to a degree.
I mean, you were out in the streets, but you didn't know any different, obviously. I mean, you know, when the troubles were very bad, obviously, you know, you didn't go off sort of wandering off for the day. If you did go off, your parents knew exactly where you were, but depending what area you lived in, I mean, you know, getting to and from school for us was, could be very problematic. Because we had a cross from the bog side. We lived just at the Lone Mirror Road. You walk under the bog side and up over the flyover and up to the long tower, up to school. So that would have been, you know, a very troublesome spot as well, you know. And, you know, just a lot of heavy stuff went on around there. So, but your parents always knew me. My parents were very, you know, very protective, obviously, very cautious, and, you know, clued into what was going on. So you didn't know any different, Johnny. You know, you really didn't. And sadly, you know, it was kind of normality for you to have such, you know, intense British military presence and intense RUC presence and other presence too.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you just didn't know any, you didn't know any different, you know, it was normality for you, really. It was far from
it was
normality.
Because,
you know,
I moved up there in 94, like I was 20 years old, maybe, you know, and I was very naive, I suppose, you know, but the atmosphere up there was very calm at the time. It was very mellow, and I think people were you know, making a concerted effort to kind of keep the peace, I suppose, you know. It did go a bit haywire around 96. I remember I moved out. It's funny. I'll tell you how naive I was, Brona. I was in a band called the Screaming Bin Lids, and I know.
Do you
remember? And I had no idea what they were singing about. I just thought, like, I'm in this punk band with all these heads. But they were a great bunch of guys. I didn't even know what the Screaming Bin Lid analogy was about. You know what I mean? You know, I only figured this stuff out much later on. But yeah, I mean, you know, I end up playing in bands up there. And actually, it's funny. I saw you wearing in the movie today. You're wearing a Stum T-shirt.
That's right, Di. Cara, our wardrobe designer on the film, she tried to get as many Derry band T-shirts on there at the time. I think she had it from back in the day, as they say.
Yeah, they would have been around, you know, when I was there. It's funny because I remember, you know, obviously a lot of great bands came out of there, and obviously the Undertones being, you know, obviously, one of the biggest bands.
when we were growing up, you know, they were like gods. They really were. They were like, oh my God. It was all about the undertones.
They're one of my favorite bands as growing up as a kid. Still are one of my favorite bands. But you know what's funny? I was at a gig one night in Derry, and it was like, it was either the Frames were playing, or it was Amy Mann. You know, I saw Amy Mann in the Guido Bar, and I saw the Divine Comedy as well. But I remember seeing John O'Neill. Who wrote, you know, Teenage Kicks, and there he was kind of lifting flight cases up those big stairs in the Guido Bar. And I just thought, wow, it kind of shows you how unforgiving this business can be. Do you know what I mean? Because you would expect him to be, you know, I suppose, have kind of made some money from it or whatever. And I suppose maybe later on when they brought in Paul McLoone and vocals, and they're probably making more, you know, a few quid again and stuff like that, you know.
They could tour again. You know, they had a sort of second lease of life. I mean, I think, you know, look, John obviously moved, you know, they never left Derry, really, the Undertones, you know, and they all lived. John lived in our street.
Ooh.
And yeah, he lived in my street in Derry, and Jacqueline Way. And we used to call in for him. You know, when you were wee, you'd call in for people.
Yeah.
So we used to knock up to his lovely wife up in the house and say, is John coming out? And see if he would come out and play. But, I mean, he was obviously out in the road then with the Undertones, were doing what he was doing. All the kids were just obsessed. He used to just walk up to the house in your Undertones T-shirts and your 45s to get them signed. But, you know, he was like Jimmy Page, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, those guys were on top of the... Imagine what it was like for your road when those guys were on top of the Pops. It was, you know, it must have been an event.
It was the second coming. Oh, my goodness, absolutely. So I think, you know... When they did, like, obviously they had their moment, and they just didn't really, you know, they didn't obviously stay together as a band with Fergal at the, you know, the front man. But they all just came back to Derry, you know, so they never really went and did the sort of, you know, we're living in LA vibration.
Yeah.
They came back and just moved back in with their, you know, their families, and they had children, and they all just worked in different, you know, other bands, and obviously that Petrol Emotion and, you know, different bands they were playing. So, yeah. And then there used to be a great venue in Derry, the Union Hall.
Yeah.
There used to be like a sort of goth night down there. And I was kind of more of a sort of rockabilly. I was under the rockabilly sort of scene, but there wasn't that many rockabillies in Derry at the time. So we used to sort of just go wherever the live music was. And that's when we used to go to the Union Hall. But you'd often see, you know, different bands. I think the Carolines were a band that Paul McLoone sang in.
They were indeed,
Right. And he used to be there on a Saturday night. So that was all the sort of, you know, the Suede Heads, is that what they were called? The Smiths and the sort of the goth.
Wow.
The goth and the sort of Fraggles. That was that kind of scene.
Because I remember the Carolines back in 1990. I was in a band called Hidden Faces, and we got into the final of the Carling Hot Press Band of 90, and the Carolines won it.
That's right.
And I was only 16 at the time, and actually the final was on the day of me doing my intercert, which is kind of your exams you do when you're 15, 16. So I had to do the exams, go to the airport in my school uniform, get on a plane, fly to Cork. It was also glamorous. But actually the highlight for me was meeting Billy Doherty, because he was the drummer in the Undertones.
Billy Doherty. And he's
just one of the sweetest guys you could ever meet, you know. But he's
an absolute sweetheart, exactly.
But he was telling me a story back in the 80s where he played a gig in UCD with the Undertones, and that night a girl got stabbed. And somebody saw from the distance, and they said that the perpetrator was wearing a white denim. Do you remember when white denim came in, whatever year that was?
Yeah, of course.
And it was all the rage at the time. And Billy said he had a white denim jacket that he used to wear, and he got kind of, picked out as the kind of person who did this. Do you know what I mean? And he said it was like brought to the cop station, you know, questioned. And he said it got quite heavy for a while because, you know, he thought he was going to get kind of pinned for this, you know what I mean, which had nothing to do with him. And you couldn't meet a more honest, sweet guy, you know.
They really are. They're just so down to it. And what a drummer.
Yeah.
What a drummer. He's incredible.
Great drummer.
They were so amazing. I really is. So,
and the trad grip as well, he plays, you know.
Yeah. Great. Oh, the Dotes. They actually had a night to celebrate them, a Lifetime Achievement Award in the OES Centre in Belfast there. God, it must be. Oh, God, how long ago this must be? It's over 10 years ago anyway. And I had the honour of presenting them their Lifetime Achievement Award.
Wow.
And Stuart Bailey and the gang at the OES asked me. And we were sort of sitting that afternoon, and they were saying, you know, it'll start the ceremony, start whatever. And I was like, I think I'd literally just arrived in Belfast that day. And I was just like, Well, I mean, it's the Undertones. Like, I mean, you just don't get up and say, here's the Undertones, here's your award. I thought, I mean, they were the only light at the end of any tunnel in Derry.
Yeah.
When we were really young, your parents, they used to do gigs for under, you know, like a pub with no beer kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So they would do gigs for kids. I mean, just back in the day,
yeah,
you know, in a sort of the, you know, rundown cinema, they'd open it for the day and everybody would pile in and you'd always get the, you know, the Smarties and the can of Fanta and watch the Undertones, mm-hmm, and the crisps.
Yeah.
So I remember thought, I better write a speech. So I remember I wrote the speech. I said, Louise, my sister and my brother-in-law, Martin, we were all having a bit of dinner beforehand. And I was like, do you know what? I just had this bolt of sort of realization. I was like, I didn't write anything. I should probably write something. So I legged it out of the restaurant, up onto the hotel, which is all in the same vicinity in the Cathedral Quarter. And I wrote a speech about basically what the Undertones meant to us as kids when they used to play Oscars, the pub with no beer. And it was like, the only way I could describe it was like Billy Doherty, you know, Mickey Bradley and the Burgundy Docks with the big, you know, 16 hot dogs, and the sound of that drum kit when you first hear it as a kid, boom, ba, boom, ba, boom, darn, as that was like a meteor coming through the roof of the building. That's the way it felt to me. It was my first, you know, real experience of live rock and roll, punk rock gigs.
Yeah.
And so I wrote this speech and I kind of went for it and it turned out well. And when they came, you know, they said, okay, you know, you, I said, he's struck. Can I speak? Like, can I make a speech? He goes, oh, of course. Oh, we'd love that. We'd love it. So I did the speech, gave it socks. And when I turned around, they were all crying at the side of the stage and they all run on and jumped up and lifted me up. And it was a love romance moment. And Billy said to me afterwards, you wouldn't give us that speech, would you? Yeah. Oh, so it was great. You know, you met your heroes. Like, well, they were your neighbors.
That's amazing. Well, you couldn't find, you know, two better ambassadors for Derry, such as yourself and those lads. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I love them. I still have my T-shirt I won at the Pub with No Beer disco, the Marvel Moore Youth Club disco, when we were really young. Now, we were still at primary school. And I remember going down to the disco with a pair of denim jeans and leg warmers up above your, over your thigh. Like, it was leg warmer vibe. And whatever the groove was at the time, a white T-shirt. And I remember the quiz was on and the competition was, who's the lead singer of Blondie? And everybody shouted Blondie and I shouted Debbie Harry and I won an Undertones T-shirt. Oh, my God. I still have it.
Oh, God.
I still have it. And it was down, like, I remember putting the T-shirt on and it was covering up my leg warmers because it was down to my ankles, literally. And I still have it. And it's threadbare, but it's the cracker T-shirt. I brought it to the stage that night. I brought it up and I showed it to them. They all went mental.
Oh, that's brilliant. This is my youngest daughter takes all my swag, you know. She's got all the Frames T-shirts and whatever I get, she takes them all, you know.
So they're, you know, vintage rock and roll T-shirts now. I was looking for a Thin Lizzy one recently because I thought, what a minute, a Thin Lizzy T-shirt.
Ah, yeah.
£200-300, you know.
Yeah, I know. They're certainly not cheap. But you did a show, Brona. It was on BBC about 5 years ago, and it was all based around Derry. Forgive me for, I've just caught bits of it. Do you remember you did that show? Because I remember you were walking the walls of Derry. I can't remember if it was like a historical show or was it just a kind of retrospective?
Oh, Nationwide, was it?
Yeah, there was. Right.
We went to Greenan as well, Greenan and Vailick up in the... Oh, just up and showing up over the border. Is that the one where I took him up to the fort?
Yeah.
That's right. A lovely Nationwide. It was lovely. Took him through the bog side and we kept meeting everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think when I left Derry, did Terry Crossan get he ran the bog side in for a long time?
That's right.
He's now a councillor up in Donegal. And you know, he was... When I was a kid, you know, when you work for someone that's a lovely person to work for and you know they treat you with respect and they've got your back. He was an absolute gent to work for, you know.
You never forget that. You never forget it. What does it say? You'll always forget what people say and do, but you'll never forget how they make you feel.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you know, you've never lost touch with your roots up there. Like, how has it changed up there now compared to, I suppose, 20, 30 years ago? I've been meaning to go back, actually. I've been dying to go and take my wife up there and kind of just walk around where I lived and, you know.
No. I mean, the city's developed a lot, obviously, you know, and, you know, it's There's a lot of, you know, great young business people running their own lovely restaurants, and, you know, obviously your heart goes out to them now in the last year, how hard it's been. But, you know, there's definitely a lot more alternative sort of evenings out that's not revolving just around the pub, you know, people just trying to do things, and a lot more confidence in younger people and people starting off their own, as I say, you know, their own businesses that aren't, you know, now, like, it's a lot more of a easier time. People are a lot more educated. They have a lot more confidence. When I was growing up there, you know, you had to be from basically certain areas in the community to sort of get a foot on some, you know, some worlds. But I think now, obviously, we're less and less, I hope, living in a sectarian divide, and the prejudice is less tolerated, and there's a lot more, you know, shared work with the medicine, you know, world, and in the police force, and education, you know. So I mean, education has been the key for so many, so it's a lot more balanced than it was when I was growing up, you know. It was still very, very serious sectarianism, and a lot of trouble, obviously. But I think, you know, we're hoping that people have really, really mellowed out, and that we don't incite any more prejudice, and you know, just look after the young people now, and keep them in the straight and narrow, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, so let me, I suppose I'll go back. If I don't ask you questions about the movies, Bronagh, my listeners will kill me, because I know you did Dear Sarah, and then obviously the commitments kind of happened fairly quickly after that. You know, when I look at yourself, and I look at Glenn and Phelim and Andrew, and, you know, like, even for the people that weren't in the movie, Bronagh, that just, like, it was such an exciting time for all of us, because, you know, it also, it brought kind of music to the forefront, you know, of what Ireland had to offer, particularly after, I suppose, you know, when the Joshua Tree came out, like, every A&R man kind of came into Ireland, and they signed up every band, except Lear. Except Lear.
Oh, no. Lear, genius.
I always make that joke. You know? But, you know, that must have been just an amazing time. And I know very well, shortly after that, then, did you, well, let me just ask you about the experience of making that film. I hope you're not sick of answering those questions about that movie.
Not at all. I mean, I am never, not at all, Johnny. I mean, you know, I never once have taken that experience or that break for granted. You know, that was like winning the lotto, really, as regards an actor or a performer, a musician, you know, whatever. When I was only 17, 18, when it came out, so, you know, I was a kid, I was still at school, I was doing my A-levels, but not at all. I never, ever take that for granted, that experience. You know, it was magical, and it was an incredible time in Irish arts. And, you know, I was speaking to a lovely girl recently who's writing a book about Irish cinema at the time, and she was telling me that, I didn't realise this, but after the success of The Commitments, a group of basically young producers and people that had a bit of a life in film before that, which obviously we didn't have the industry that we do now, there wasn't an established functioning Irish Film Board until after The Commitments. They reinstated it. They went to the Irish Film Board and said, come on, can we just basically get this back up on its feet again? That's the impact, obviously, The Commitments had, not just on the film, you know, structure and industry here in the country, but obviously, you know, on all the careers and the people that it sort of it ignited. So, no, it was an amazing experience, you know, just to have, obviously, got that opportunity to work with Alan Parker, got the opportunity to start to make records with people, and, you know, lifelong friendships, and, you know, my relationship with Connor, who I work a lot with still, who played guitar on the movie and the soundtrack. So, you know, that I don't take for granted. You know, it kind of moved me to Dublin, and obviously, you know, I've been in and out of Dublin for the last 30 years between here and London and America. So, no, it was a life-changing experience, you know, and one that is, thank God, it's something that, you know, we are all so proud of still. I mean, it could have been, you know, oh, that film was terrible. It's not. It's such a wonderful
Absolutely.
It
being a young musician around that time as well, it almost validated our existence to a degree. Do you know what I mean? And it gave you a sense of hope, you know?
Yep, very, very much so.
And actually, when you talk about the film industry, I mean, what in terms of the Irish our film industry, I mean, before that we had Taffin and maybe The Courier, or you know what I mean? Like, Irish films weren't, you know, unless someone like John Ford was coming to Ireland, or, you know, David Lean, or, you know, outside production. But yeah, I never really thought of that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you've seen the skill of the casting, which was, you know, impeccable, and that obviously, you know, it catapulted the Hubbards to global status then, who cast this film, who found these people. And obviously, you know, the incredible musicians that worked in it, and, you know, the wonderful crew and all the, you know, all the amazing extras in the movie as well, all the sort of tiny little parts that just were such an incredible support, and just the raw talent of the band themselves, you know. So, and obviously, you know, we all have to remember, and it's easy to say this when somebody's, you know, no longer here, but Alan Parker was a master filmmaker and never made any film in any way resemble his other films. You know, he was a unique storyteller, and, you know, he brought the finest out of every cast that he worked with and every storyline. And he his array of films throughout his career were kind of extraordinary. There's no other director that has actually, you know, walked into the words that he's walked into and made such impeccable films each time.
Absolutely. I mean, for a guy to go from Bugsy Malone to Midnight Express, you know,
100%.
He's just had an influence. And then you've movies like Angel Heart in the 80s. I was, you know, back then a director would sell a movie, you'd go, oh, Alan Parker's made a movie, let's go see that. You know what I mean? It's, you know,
why?
He was just a phenomenal, phenomenal talent. So when you finished shooting that, did you... There was maybe a year or two between that and, like, Pulp Fiction. Did you move out to LA quickly after that, or?
No, because, I mean, at the time, you know, you needed a visa, obviously, to live in LA. I think, you know, I went out for the movie coming out when the premieres and all happened, and that was kind of mind-blowing to be in LA, and, you know, people knew who you were, and you had all the movie stars and everything coming to the premieres. But, you know, it just always felt like such an alien place to me, and... You know, it all happened so quickly when I was like 17, 18, you know, did the Dear Sarah, then did the Commitments the following summer, and then boom, the next summer, you know, I'm 19 and it's like, what? But my ambition was to do theatre acting and to train as an actress. Now, you know, maybe because of my grandparents, my mum's parents always loved movies. They loved the old movies. They loved theatre. They knew so much about, you know, the theatre world in Britain. My granddad had, I suppose, he had sort of been involved in amateur dramatics in Derry. Mm. You know, he knew all about Sir Laurence Olivier and the National Theatre and Maggie Smith and all the wonderful actors, Gielgud, that, you know, they'd worked with. And I suppose, in a way, I felt that to me was the class that I needed. That was the training that I needed. And I just thought, if I can have that craft to my belt, as it were, if I get that training, then, you know, I know then maybe I can be a professional actor. So in my stubborn kind of way, I thought I had to go to theatre school in order to become an actor. I wanted the training. I wanted the craft. I wanted to master it, and or whatever, you know, whatever that means. So my ambition was to go to drama school in England. And so I came back and Dear Sarah days, I had auditioned for like 6 or 7 drama schools in England and didn't get into any.
Right.
And then after the Commitments, I sort of came straight back and went to the Abbey Theatre for a year. And that to me was my, you know, for me, that was the training that I wanted.
Yeah.
So that took me up to about 20, 21. And then at 21, I went to LA to visit a friend. And I met Quentin and the gang out there, just literally just happened to be there at the time they were doing the Pulp Fiction thing.
Yeah.
But at 21, I joined the Royal Shakespeare Company in London in a co-production with the RSC. Nina Gawa, who was a very respected, brilliant Japanese director, and they did this completely insane production of Peer Gynt, Henry Gibson's Peer Gynt. So I started rehearsing in London for that January 94, I think. And the tour lasted for 6 or 7 months. And then from that, worked with Stephen Frears after that on Mary Reilly.
Oh, yeah.
So just kept doing, you know, movies, theatre, love the theatre. And then at about 24, I joined Theatre de Complicity. So all the training that I didn't get with theatre school, when I joined Simon McBurney's company, Complicity, that was a 5-year, more or less, on and off stint. And that was like, you know, touring a lot, America, yeah. Japan again, Scandinavia, and West End runs. We did 2 different runs in the Barbican and then in the West End in London. So that was, to me, like a 5-year on and off period of like working with one of the best directors there is, really, Simon McBurney.
Wow. And I mean, in between all of that stuff, you were doing kind of like TV stuff and, you know, parts in movies. I mean, you always seem to have a foothold in movies all the time, whether, you know, from the early 90s all the way up through that, you know?
Always working. I mean, it's funny because this whole year, the last year, obviously the pandemic year, I have never had a year off to myself. I mean, I've had periods where you weren't working, which was difficult and challenging and stressful. You just had that, every actor or every musician knows, where there's just no work around.
Yeah.
I've been there, and obviously through that, I chose to focus on writing my own music, you know, just to keep my brain active and, you know, not to get down about not feeling, you know, wanted or part of something. But I've never really had that amount of time off, which has kind of been an incredible relief just to be free for a while, because I worked with touch wood, you know, I worked kind of nonstop from I was from when I was 17, 18, you know, and, you know, didn't realize how tired I was.
I was the exact same. I actually, having not gigged for a year, Brona, I didn't actually mind it, you know?
Exactly.
Right? I spent more time with my family. It's, you know, you know, this pandemic could put any marriage to the test. And thankfully, I've you know, experienced nothing but gratitude for just slowing things down, you know? But so, I mean, obviously music's played a huge part in your life, but it was 2004 when you put your first record out with Precious Soul.
Yeah.
You know, you're always moving forward, Brona. You're all, you know, and that, for me, that record, like, all three albums that you've done are very different. I found your first album had a more country flavor to it.
Because I love country music, you know. I love, obviously, Dolly Parton and Hank Williams and Townes Van Sant, and all the stuff that we sort of grew up listening to, and Emmylou Harris, and, you know, my mum and dad are big country fans, and obviously, Johnny Cash, you know, I just felt these were just songs that just sort of came out as a process of sort of osmosis, or, you know, listening to that stuff. I just think, you know, I was really, really young and just wanted to just sort of see what the song sounded like. So I just made the record. And as I've got older, my love, you know, for soul music is always apparent in my own music. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be involved in the commitment so much, was because of my love for soul, and that never, you know, depletes. It only gets stronger. And as you go down the hole, the soul hole, you know, discovering different, you know, worlds of soul in different parts of the States and different parts of England, where, you know, you thought, oh, you might have knew about this wee, you know, this wee bubble, but you don't. And there's just so much to figure out, like in all music, you know, in all music, all genres. But yeah, you know, I mean, I just feel, you know, I love writing music. I love making it, creating it, producing it. So, you know, I suppose it's something that I just feel I've gained more confidence as I've got older, you know, and just the passion is huge for it.
Well, I remember we did a gig together in Vicar Street. It might have been New Year's Eve with the Frames. And I think it was just yourself and Connor. And I can't remember who was on bass, you just went out as a three-piece and you were playing drums as well. But
that's right.
You came out initially, and I remember, because I'd always go out and watch whoever's playing before us, and I went out, and you sang a song a cappella, just came out and sat behind the kit, and you just did this song on your own. It might have been St. Teresa.
It was St. Teresa, yeah, God, it's right
there. Oh, go on. because there's always a bit of Aretha in there, Donna, there's always, you know, but that's a very powerful song, very uplifting song, you know. But you did.
I love a cappella singing, obviously, and, you know, harmony singing and women's voices together. You know, it doesn't matter, men or women, you know.
Yeah.
But I have a huge love of gospel music, obviously, and a huge love of Irish, you know, singing. And, you know, I just think when you hear the human voice, it's the purest of the instruments, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, there's always a very kind of a nakedness to just hearing it on its own, and a vulnerability as well.
Aye.
You know, and to hear somebody sing in a room in front of 1,500 people where you could hear a pin drop.
Aye.
You know, and that's what I love about that room, is that you can come out there and do that. I saw Sinead O'Connor there 2 years ago.
Aye.
And I mean, she was in great form, and I'd never seen her play live, and it was just a bit, her voice is just incredible. Aye.
Powerful.
You know, not a dry eye in the house by the end of it. But so when you did you find, like, because when you went on to your second album, which was just self-titled, you worked with Brian Eno and John Reynolds on that one.
Hi, Brian and John worked. Well, the first album, Precious Soul, John Reynolds produced it, and right. Brian sings on it, and he also wrote some strings with Neil Catchpole for a couple of the tracks. So, you know, Brian and John are old mates from London, and I, you know, obviously love the two of them. We have such a laugh together. I don't know what the dynamic is between the three of us, but it's very silly. It's like children, and we just laugh a lot with the same sort of warped, naughty sense of humour. But they just were so encouraging about, I think we just bonded through our love of music and different artists. And, you know, when you meet people that are as obviously obsessed and as passionate about music as, you know, as I have always been. I mean, music is my first love. And growing up, I wasn't really that interested in boys so much or anything else, but I was interested in how these records were made. That, you know, I was just, that was my obsession, was who recorded that? You know, I can't get enough of these vinyls. I can't get enough of the information. And as kids, you know, really just like utterly devouring the vinyl and what the information that it gave you, and the information that who are these? You know, who's Billy Preston? Why is he not on the cover? You know, who's George Martin? Why is he not on the cover? You know, what did he do then? You know, what did this guy do? What's an engineer? You know, all the stuff that you just become obsessed with. So as you, because my mom and dad were so passionate about it as well and encouraging, when you meet, you know, somebody like John, who's as obsessed with, you know, Curtis Mayfield albums and the Impressions albums, you know, and you're able to talk to people like this, and they want to sit and talk about, you know, Stevie Wonder albums or, you know, Clyde Stubblefield. And, you know, your Gaird friends growing up in Derry, we had the crack and we're all still great mates, but they don't want to, they don't care who the Sweet Inspirations are. They'll listen to the Dorothy Murr track and they'll listen to the Dionne Warwick. You know, they want to know who the Sweet Inspirations are because they sing on the back of that Aretha track. Who sings that? Who cares? Let's go.
Yeah.
But when you meet somebody that actually gives a monkey about, you know, who Jerry Wexler is or who, you know, Arif Mardin is, and then you meet somebody like Eno who's, you know, on another level of knowledge. I didn't really know a lot of Brian's work, which was probably refreshing for him, that I wasn't, you know, torturing him about David Bowie, or, you know, I didn't have a great knowledge of David Bowie's music when I met Brian, or that he worked with Talking Heads. To me, he knew who the Shirelles were, and to me, he knew who, you know, Darlene Love was, and, you know, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. And I was like, oh, Jesus, dude knows everything. It's great. You know, then come to my house and see my record collection. And I was like, uh-oh. You know, and that was our friendship. And, you know, so then, you know, obsessed with Fela Kuti, obsessed with, you know, the great studio recordings, the Studio Ones, you know.
Yeah.
So when you meet people that are encyclopedic, messengers of this kind of work, it's just love. You just there. You don't give a monkeys about anything, but just sitting, finding out about records and how they're made, who recorded them. And then they actually, you know, for Brian, I think, who's so part of the ambient sound and, you know, almost created it in a sense.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. So, the you know, they were the ones that encouraged me to make my own record. You know, they were saying, you know, you're a producer, you should make your own stuff. I mean, I was mortified at the thought that they even thought that. But, you know, they, again, they gave me confidence to do it. So when it came to the second album, they said, you should just produce this yourself.
Right.
You know, you're well able. So that's kind of where that all come from. And then on the last album, Brian sings as well on radio, you know, so he's just a great confidant and a great friend, and you know, to have in your corner.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
I just an absolute genius. I remember you brought Brian and John to a Frames gig in Bush Hall in London, and
in the Borderline.
Was it, where was it? The Border, or was it Bush Hall? I remember
it was Bush Hall, and Brian came to that, and then Lexington. But I brought Brian. We went for sushi, and I think it was me, Robbie Malone, and Brian, and I brought him to see the Frames. And God of Mercy, Mick Christopher was guitar teching at it.
Oh, was it? Who was it? Was Mick teching on that one?
Yeah.
Oh, this would have been later on then. This would have been later on, Bronagh, because Simon was teching at that point. Simon Good, who was in the Mary Janes with Mick, but. What I remember about that night, obviously you were very gracious and introduced me to Brian. He was a lovely guy. And John Reynolds lent me a set of drums that night, which Glenn did he did a Kurt Cobain at the end of the gig and jumped into the kit. And I'm thinking, if John Reynolds sees
gorgeous 1930s cherry.
He gave me this lovely kit, and there's Glenn jumping in. And I thought, and I know John Reynolds, like, is he a black belt and something? And I thought, he's going to kill me.
Yes, he is in jiu-jitsu. He would. Yeah. Do you know what that was? That was the University of London.
Was it the okay?
That was that. I know that's right. I brought him to another gig, and my brother Paul was there, and his wife Laura. That's right. That was London, the University of London in town. That's right.
God bless your memory. Is it, just looking at the amount of work, because you know we do work in a very transient industry, you know, and just looking at the amount of stuff that you've done, you know, is there pockets where you're just like, somebody might quote something you're in, you're just like, I don't remember that, I'm sorry. Do people ever do that?
You know, I mean, I think what I've learned in the last, you know, few years is, I suppose, as we get older, and you know, hindsight's a great thing, but I suppose, you know, sometimes you would take jobs out of thinking, oh, this is going to be good fun, or these are nice people, whatever, and they don't work out, and they're not nice experiences. But, you know, I think as I've got older, what I've done is I've been a lot more, when I can, a lot more just choosy about what I want to do, and I suppose valuing my own time, where I'm kind of going, well, you know, that's my time, and is this a good idea? And, you know, just making sure you're doing things for the right reasons, because, you know, your time is precious.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how I view my life now, you know, that if I'm going to bring my energy to something and bring other people to it, I want to know that it's going to be, you know, number one, that you're going to be valued, and number two, that it's going to be something that stimulates you creatively.
Yeah.
And not to be something that's going to be a drain, you know, because I think as artistic people and in the artistic community, we're so blessed to do what we do, and we're very, very lucky to do what we do. We love our jobs, we love the people that we meet, you know, and it's, you know, it's a very inspiring position to be in for other people as well. And I think if you can help people through your work or your music, I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to be able to do in life. And I've, you know, at the small level that we're at, musically, you know, I know people come to me and say, that really helped me, that song, or, you know, that got me through a really difficult time, the way music gets me through difficult times. So it's kind of a gift in itself, you know, to be able to say, you know, this is
absolutely
what we do. So,
but
I've certainly done things where I kind of went, oh, God, that's crap. But, you know, I did it. I got the experience from it. And you learn. I mean, you sometimes only learn from the tough times, not so much the good times when, you know, you're not thinking about, oh, that was really difficult, and, you know, or that was such a brilliant experience, I don't have anything but good to take away. But, you know, sometimes you learn, you know, hard lessons from good things as well, you know.
Absolutely. Well, there's always that thing as well of just striving, you know, to do good work, like to make a good record, to write a good song, to, you know, because I ended up in a situation where I was very unhappy for quite some time, you know. And it's like what you say, Brian. It's the same, you know, music. We are, you know, there's three things we consider: the people, the music, and the money. You know, and if you can get the music and the people right, you don't care about the money as much, you know.
Right.
And sometimes you might take a job where you go, well, look, the money's great on this, and ultimately you're unhappy. You know, and yeah. That can happen a lot. I'm at the other side of that now, and it feels great. It feels really liberating.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I'm moving forward. I have a couple of new albums coming out this year, and I can't wait to get out and play them. You know.
Great. Brilliant.
I've been waiting a long time for that. You know what I mean? So congratulations on the single you just did with Noel Hogan. I saw you on the Late Night Show 2 weeks ago. How did that come about?
Well, I had a chat a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago, with a friend in London who was in Warner Chappell and publishing, and they mentioned Noel and that he was, you know, writing with other people, and would I be interested? I was like, yeah. I mean, I've never really, you know, worked with people that I don't know. Obviously, I work very closely with Connor and Cian, and from the you know, the score point of view, as a lyricist, I've always just written on my own, and I just felt, God, that would be a really interesting opportunity. And then, you know, I think nothing came of it. It was only mentioned, and then I started working last February, just literally pre-lockdown with Kira Davey, who was the tour manager for the Cranberries. And Kira and I have known each other, you know, in the sort of Dublin scene for a good few years. But she approached me and just sort of has always, I think, been a great supporter of what I've done and understands, you know, what it's like to be a woman in the music industry.
Yep.
And you know, I use that term, the industry, lightly and loosely. But, you know, for myself, doing my own thing, literally from my own kitchen table. And she just says, look, I'd love to give you a hand. And she's been amazing, because it was her that then set up the initial meeting with myself and Noel virtually. Because I said, you know, Noel was going to write with other people. How's he getting on? She goes, well, let me ask him, because I think, you know, you two should work together and do something. So we just literally got on the Skype together and had a chat. And he says, look, let me send you some music. I was like, I'd love to. And he sent me the track, and I just took it away and lockdown then, boom. And I went to Derry, and obviously was near my parents, so I was able to keep an eye on them. Yeah. And we literally wrote Crybaby. You know, he sort of gave me free rein. The title was there, so I sort of kept the title and the sort of middle, you know, just the melody in the chorus. It was quite sort of tied. I was quite limited to what I could do with that. But I just went walking in the hills of Derry, Donegal, and as you said yourself there, just rested and did loads of yoga, which I love. And
yeah.
I just went for it, and I just sort of thought, well, I'll give him what I've come up with and see what he thinks. So I sent it off, thinking, you know, if he wants to record it with somebody else, that's fine. You know, it's just an idea, a lyrical story of somebody, whatever, releasing somebody from love or releasing somebody, you know, do whatever, just a release up to heaven or whatever you want to send people off into space. But he loved it, and that's literally the vocal that we used from the track.
Wow,
so
amazing.
I just recorded it up in Camden with Connor, and we sent it off, and said, let's see what he thinks. But, you know, it's been such a joyful experience, the whole thing, you know, and he's such a easy person to work with, and it was just the thing for both of us. We're both really surprised at how well it's been received, because it's sonically so different to what the world where I'm always in, me sort of, you know, my Stax Motown kind of place.
Yeah.
So it was a great challenge, you know, but I'm really chuffed that he was so chuffed, you know.
Oh, that's great. And you mentioned Kira Davey. She's somebody who, she's tour managed a lot of people, like Avicii as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny.
That's right.
You just mentioned her name, Brona, and I actually don't know her personally, but her dad's my accountant.
Yeah, he's my accountant too.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I always ring him around the 15th of October every year to be like, where
crying the phone,
hurling abuse at the, down to me on the phone. You know what I mean? No, what are you ringing me this late in the year for? He's a great guy. That's so funny.
Yeah, she's a great woman.
But you know, it's great to see you just putting out new music, and even, you know, with what we're seeing on TV with, you know, obviously I think RTE, particularly the Late Lakes and the Tommy Tiernan Show, have been trying to support Irish music to a large degree, yeah. But there still doesn't seem to be a big enough outlet for the level of talent and the amount of it we have here. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do, you know, I'd love to see us obviously have our own regular show, like, you know, the Later with Jules, you know, set up that show was celebrated in a live studio environment. I know they have the other voices and stuff like that, but you know, do you really just, yeah, do you celebrate it? Because there's so much music, there's so much traditional music, there's so many people from the different, you know, our own wonderful traditions that we have, and I just do really think there's an open. I think a lot of people are trying to now with all of the different budgets that have come in and funding for, you know, traditional music and you know, self-penned in our own country music. I think it's definitely that idea is definitely growing legs, and I can definitely, you know, I know that there's a lot of good people behind ideas and submitting really good programs at the minute, so hopefully their funding going to come through. You know,
I think there was a general feeling though, disappointment with Irish radio in the sense that they could have potentially done a little bit more in this last year to maybe just play a little bit more Irish music and let those musicians get some royalties because they're not working. You know, and I know that argument's been going on for as long as I can remember. You know, I don't think it's going to change very much, which is unfortunate. But as you say, just having a Jules Holland type show, because the wealth of talent we have here, like, they would never run out of bands or musicians. And there's been a huge influx in female artists. I've never seen, you know, and particularly the R&B culture and black culture in Ireland as well. This is a whole, you know.
Bring it on. Big time.
And thankfully, I get to work with your bass player, Robbie and Connor, and we work in colleges. Yeah. And, you know, we kind of mentor these kids and we help them. And it's just great to see some of the talent emerging, you know. I'm feeling like a relic, Bronagh, at this stage.
No, but you see, but it's great, and it's a very important point as well, Johnny, because, you know, there's a huge argument for, you know, what we grew up feeling. I definitely felt as a woman from the north of Ireland and, you know, a Catholic girl, without making it a religious conversation here, but, you know, the lack of confidence that we felt as Irish people, there was always the post-colonial, you know, discrepancy that we felt, that if it came from England, it was better. If it came from America, it was even better. You know, we had an inadequacy about ourselves and our own talent, lack of understanding of the business, how many extraordinary artists in this country, and you said it, Lear, one of the most extraordinary group of artists that I've ever come across, you know, skilled musicians. We've never seen anything like the talent of that band, as good as it got, as good as it gets. And they were absolutely, you know, on their knees from you know, uncool and ungood people getting their hands on their music and their publishing and all the details. You know, and when you now look at the kids of you know, that are involved in the music now and the wonderful R&B scene in Ireland and the singer-songwriters, and they can be almost self-taught because of the internet and all the positive aspects of social media, the positive aspects of the, you know, of what's available, you know, they don't have that sense of guilt or inadequacy or lack of confidence. They have, if anything, too much confidence, you know, and it's fantastic. They're giving it socks. So luckily we've seen that shift in our sense of Irishness and, you know, the greatest Irish band ever, Thin Lizzy, you know, what that band were and what that band musically stood up for. You look back at, you know, you listen to Live and Dangerous and you listen back and you watch footage of Thin Lizzy, it doesn't get any better as regards a rock outfit. But what they didn't have was, you know, all the support and the skill and the sobriety that people need, or the balance of, you know, having a bit of crack and, you know, not letting it destroy you. Like we've seen it do so many toxicity, you know, so many amazing artists.
Yeah.
You know, what we do now have is the guidelines for that. And young people are much more into their fitness and their health and looking after themselves and being sexy, do you know?
Yeah.
So that's what we didn't have growing up, unless you were very, very lucky. And, you know, whereas the bands like U2 had, you know, the accountants behind them, they had the business understanding, they had the support, you know, they had the confidence and they had the ambition.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had the clever people looking after them to keep them, you know, straight, and they had a vision for themselves, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the difference now. And, you know, it's wonderful to see it. You know, it's just a pity that so many young bands in Ireland were destroyed because of greedy, you know, greedy assholes, you know.
Well, I think the younger generation as well are allowed to have more autonomy now with their music.
Yeah.
Because most of them are recorded. I mean, you go to make your record, Brona, like I don't, like, you know, 20 years ago, if you didn't have a record deal, you couldn't afford to go in the studio, you know.
Not at all.
Like I made the second Picture House album and it cost 60 grand, you know, back in 1998. And we still finance that ourselves. You know, but
big time. I mean, I, you know, absolutely. And, you know, there's something to be said. I mean, I run my own independent label. I run my own thing. I put everything through my own label.
Yeah.
And that's why, because I want to make the music that I want to make. And I don't owe anybody any money from that, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're straight and honest about who wrote what and you keep it clear. But, you know, I've seen how people that did have the record deals as well and the big investments from outside record companies, and then if that record doesn't sell, who's going to fit the bill?
Yeah
And that can destroy people as well, you know. And it has, and I've seen so many wonderful bands and individuals left them with this huge bill, you know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as well, for a lot of Irish bands in the late 80s early 90s, like bands like A House and maybe the Fat Lady Sing, Something Happens, a lot of them kind of got chewed up and spat out over in the UK.
Why?
You know, where record labels spent a lot of money you know, on them, and they just didn't get the recoup, you know. I remember, I think my old man told me he went to see Something Happens in London once, and they're a great band, great bunch of lads.
Oh, but, you know, fabulous.
He said they had this massive production, huge venue, and he said there was like five people at it, you know.
No. And that's it. It's all about accountants at the end of the day, and it's all about, you know, like anything, it's always going to come down to money. And I mean, I think because we experienced that at a very young age with the commitments, and though we were never a band and it was only a movie, but, you know, as soon as we'd done our third kind of trip to LA and, you know, whatever concert this or concert that, as in just like an event that we would sing at, we never toured as a band, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as that was over and the budget for that year was spent, you know, you were sort of at Dublin Airport, left stranded, waiting for somebody's, you know, somebody's daddy come and get you in a van, which literally happened. So, you know, I think I learned that very early on, thinking, well, you know, there's no such thing as free money. Like,
no. Was it the Dubliners or the Chieftain said they used to get a limo to Wembley to play Wembley, and then they get the tube back. You know, it was one of those kind of things. You know,
big time.
But was there around that time, was anybody trying to kind of get a commitments band going? You know, because I know some of the lads went off and did their own thing. What was there a discussion about that, or was it just everybody kind of? Because I'm sure Glenn had his deal with Island Records, and I'm sure Andrew wanted to go off and do his own thing as well. But what was it considered at one point?
Well, I think from pretty much the get-go, Dick Massey and Ken McCluskey had a commitments band on the go. They were called The Committed, I think.
That's right.
So they had a great life of that. They toured all over. So they went out as the band from the movie, and there was a few original members in it, but I never was part of it. I just wanted to act, you know, so I just obviously went and did all the... all the sort of theatre work that I did for the years that I did. But I know they had a great lifespan with it. Yeah, they had a great time.
They did. Well, Andrew's still packing them in up in Norway and Denmark. I did a few shows with them two years ago. And again, you know, for me, it was great to kind of just play all those tunes. You know, and he still sounds great as ever. And he's given...
Oh, aye, great front man. Aye, he's great.
But, you know, it's funny because I know when you guys got back together, it was 25th anniversary. Was that weird in any way? Because, you know, when you think back to the movie, everybody's, you know, when you've got all that youthful optimism when you're, you know, in your late teens, early 20s. But then when you come back and some people have had record deals, some people have had more success than other people. Glenn's won his Oscar, you know, Andrew's, you know, was it a fun thing to do? Was it just a nice bit of nostalgia, and or would it have had a bit more legs in it? Do you know what I mean? Whereas you could have taken it on tour for longer.
Well, Well, I think it was the 20th year anniversary, wasn't it? Like 20 years, because that's 30 years now. So, you know, it was only three or four shows. London, Manchester, maybe. No, I beg your pardon. London, Liverpool, Glasgow and Dublin. Oh, no, it was great crack. I mean, it was 3 weeks and we rehearsed, you know, and we did obviously put the work in here in Dublin and then we went off and did the gigs. But I mean, yeah, I mean, some people chose not to have a career in this game. Some people, it just, you know, it just wasn't something I think that they really sort of felt that they had that kind of, you know, will to do. But it was a great experience. I mean, the fact that you would stand out in front of, you know, 15, 16,000 people in the Point, and the I still call the Point.
The Point.
But no, I think, you know, when you stood out there and you realized how important of a movie it was for so many people, it was very moving, you know, that was kind of mind blowing. You just sort of get out there and you just see that that was, you know, people's favorite movie. So it was a great, I think what I found out of that whole experience was it was a renewed sense of respect for the film that we were, it wasn't our movie, it was everybody's movie, you know, it belonged to so many people and that's really what that's about. So it was a great celebration of something that a lot of the time, because you would get recognised from it on a sort of daily basis, you know, most days you go out and about, people say, oh, the Commitments, you know. So, you know, that sometimes it's a real, it sort of, it can be, you know, like, here we go again. But at the same time, you have to do it with dignity and grace and, you know, how again, as I say, how lucky we were to be in it, you know.
Yeah.
Could have been very different. I'm sure my life would have been very different if I wasn't in the Commitments, you know.
Well, I mean, it's just led to one of the most diverse careers I've ever seen. And, you know, I mean, would you consider yourself to be a character actor? Is that still a thing? Like, you know, where people refer to other actors as a character actor?
I think it's more, I mean, you know, there's lead actors and then there's character actors and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, every character, every part you play is a character. I suppose it's kind of a more... It's sort of a sort of, you know, 60s or 70s term, isn't it? You know, character actor. So character actor is the sort of the supporting actor, I think, in that genre. But, you know, the characters that support the leads. So you have your lead actors, you know, your romantic leads and stuff like that. So I suppose in a way it is, I've played those kind of parts, like character actors. So suppose they bring in, you know, the comedy element or the sort of, you know, the quirky element, as opposed to being a lead. But I suppose I'm playing a wee bit more leads and I bump along the way. That was a lead, you know, a shared lead. So, yeah, but that, I mean, I think they're more challenging sometimes, the character part.
Because actually the last thing I did watch you do, I watched it over Christmas and I thought it was a lovely film. Was The Personal History of David Copperfield.
Ah, that's a nice one.
It's just so beautifully shot. And what a cast.
I know. Sitting in the makeup truck one morning, I was like, check out this cast, man.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, Hugh in one chair, Hugh Laurie and Tilda next to him and Dev Patel and then Paul Whitehouse holding court, telling everybody the most hysterical stories because he is hysterical.
He is.
And Daisy, you know, and you're sitting there and, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing, really. Yeah, that was great. And the gorgeous Paul. Paul was in one chair and Hugh and then Dev. Who else was there? Oh, God, they were all on. I think it was one day that everybody...
because there's a scene towards the end where you're all in the scene, you know.
That's what it was. The scene in the Victorian house towards the end. That was kind of mind blowing.
How was Armando Iannucci to work with? Because he's someone, obviously, I've admired him. He's just a genius, you know?
He is, you know. I mean, he's incredible. I think I was a wee bit overwhelmed, but he was just, you know, his mind goes a mile a minute. So he was incredible. They watched direct and then he might rehearse for, you know, 2 days and then he'll change everything at the last minute. But he just, Like all the lads were saying to me, you know, just keep up, keep up. It's okay. Trust him. Keep up, keep up. Because he works like a whirlwind, but he's incredible. Like he's a master director as well.
Yeah, he's just and again, you look at The Thick of It, The Death of Stalin. He did a few years ago. Amazing film.
Yeah, amazing.
You know,
film,
obviously Alan Partridge. You know, it's funny. I saw him being interviewed, and he just said, like, you know, as much as people love Alan Partridge, when you have to spend 18 months with Alan Partridge, you just have to walk away from it. Do you know what I mean? He says it's so intense. You know. But I'm a huge fan of his, and it's funny. I was going through. I remember you told me a story ages ago. You were in a movie called Last Chance Harvey, with Dustin Hoffman.
That's right.
And did you tell me that? You know, he just really liked what you were doing, so he got the writer to actually write a specific scene so the two of you could share a scene together. Is that right?
At the end, because the ending wasn't working. And they came back to shoot the end again. And we were out in Stansted. And it was so funny because the Derry flight was coming in. And I thought, God, I hope somebody sees me now and tells me, ma, here's maybe Dustin Hoffman. And the crack, not a sinner. You'd always meet somebody from Derry. Like, but no, the crack was good. But he just said, you know, just let us do our thing here. Because, you know, I think he just, you know, knew we could improvise and try and find the character where Emma had gone. And, you know, Aki was great. He was a great... He was a great ally, Dustin Hoffman, you know, because sometimes it can be difficult. And he's such a brilliant actor. I think obviously people get slightly overwhelmed asking actors like that to play a bit. But that's their life. That's their talent, you know. No, he was great. And Emma's great as well, you know. So it's a lovely experience. And it's a lovely film, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because a lot of these movies kind of propped up. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about this one. You know, like for example, even Spin the Bottle, like with Michael McElhattan.
Yeah, God, aye, that's a while ago.
It is a while ago. And I mean, Path to Freedom is just one of the greatest series ever created. I mean, you know, just that character and the way he played that character. And he went to RADA, didn't he? He went to RADA, but he's a phenomenal actor, you know.
Michael's wonderful, Michael McElhattan. He's brilliant. Rats, yes, he's great. He's doing great. Michael's brilliant. No, and himself and Ian and the whole story, all the characters, it was brilliant.
Peter MacDonald as well, fabulous in it.
Peter's brilliant. Dio Kane, oh my God, she was so funny.
Well, I used to go and watch Deirdre O'Kane down in the Laughter Lounge back in the like mid to late 90s where she used to do her Bono.
Oh, Deirdre's a scream.
She'd do the Bono with the fly glasses and come out giving it loads. And she was brilliant. She was brilliant back in the day. It's funny actually because I was standing outside Holles Street. My wife was, we were having our second baby and we were actually, it was around the time when Path to Freedom was massive on TV and my wife was holding onto the railings, right, having contractions. I was trying to get her into the building and Michael McElhattan walked by and he just gave this kind of very sympathetic look at me and my wife. And of course, Brian, I wasn't quick enough. I should have looked at him and said, I don't believe this. You know, I wasn't quick enough.
Well, you wouldn't. Your mind was in other things.
Oh, it was. Well, funny, as I was driving it, I forgot the camera. I wanted to stop and buy a camera. My wife's like, get me to the fucking hospital.
No, Michael's great. But that really was a cracker show.
So there's other movies like Mary Riley, which obviously Stephen Frears you got to work with, who did The Snapper. I watched something he did recently, which I thought was, again, another phenomenal director like Alan Parker, who's done a variety of work. I mean,
he's great.
He did a great thing with the comic strip called Mr. Jolly Lives Next Door with Peter Cook, and essentially Rick Mayall and Adrian Evans kind of playing those bottom characters. If you haven't seen that, it's definitely it's one I would definitely fish out. I remember you had just done Star Wars, Brona, and you were living with your friends down in Harold's Cross at the time. I remember. I can't remember her name. We used to have music sessions. She was like in a basement flat or it was near Harold's Cross. Anyway, so we used to have these great...
Yeah, Kenilworth Road.
It was Kenilworth Road, right? Yeah,
yeah.
And Wally from Pugwash would be down with the guitar and everyone would be kind of playing tunes. And it was a great time, you know? It's a great time.
It was a magic time when we discovered... We discovered Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah.
We discovered Zep 4 and the neighbours used to come down and complain and I was like, you know, I'd probably be up for murder. We discovered Zep 4 and that was it. And then it was all about the Bonham bass drum and I'm sure that was lovely, 3 a.m.
I just did a record with John Parrish. I don't know if you know John Parrish, but...
I do indeed, of course.
John's amazing and he brought me like this kit for the session, the big 26-inch bass drum, and just the sound. It's just amazing. Mm. He great guy to work with. I had such a great experience with him. But wow. Funnily enough, there's one thing I'm in that you're in, which is the Lear documentary. So yeah. I'm in that. Wow. And also, I remember the most fertile man in Ireland. I mean, there's a blast from the past with Chris.
Oh, there's a blast from the past.
Chris Marshall, James Nesbitt.
That's right.
You know, and I mean, Dudi Appleton directed that. But I remember, so basically, the song they used for that movie was Sunburst, and they edited. You know, they do those videos of the edit footage from the movie. But I remember, when was that? 1999 or something.
That would have been 1998, 1999, yeah, because I was living in London. I just bought a wee flat there, and I came home to do that movie. Yeah, it would have been autumn.
Yeah.
Of 99, yeah, you're right.
Because I remember I went down, Emer Reynolds was editing that, and she was also editing the music video. And like she you know, she did I Went Down, and she went on to do that documentary, The Farthest, and she did the Phil Lynott documentary as well.
Right.
You know, she's had a great career,
great.
You know.
She's
moved on to Grace. But I remember bumping into her at Slane at U2, and she was with Brendan Coyle, who played Dr. Jeremy Fitzgerald in Paths to Freedom. Great actor. I think he's in Downton Abbey now.
Right, Brendan's great. And he went to Downton Abbey then.
Yeah. And again, he was great in Paths to Freedom. And I suppose I'd be a little bit starstruck when I meet people like that, because for me, I think comedy, I don't know what you're feeling on this. What's the most difficult genre for you to film? Because I've...
Comedy.
It's got to be comedy, hasn't it?
Because it's either funny or it's not. But I mean, I have a very, you know, low threshold for bad comedy. To me, there's some people that are just hysterical and you can't debate them, you know, like Kirsten Veig and, you know, brilliant female comedians like that, you know, and obviously Jack Galifianakis and, you know, the old school cats that we all love, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
Like Richard Pryor, Billy Connolly, stuff like that. But I mean, I do think there's been the benchmark for comedy shifted because, you know, I just don't... I don't laugh at a lot of stuff, but I mean, comedy is difficult to get it right, to make it something new, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the movies of like the last few years, well, you talk Kristen Wiig. I mean, Bridesmaids was a great movie.
Aye.
You know, Bridesmaids was great. I watched her latest one. Is it Bar and Mar Go to Vista Del Mar?
I screamed. I loved it. I just think she's a
strength. She's so good. Oh. And then she shows up in Wonder Woman 2 as a kind of baddie, and she's great. Aye. You know?
That's right.
Really, really good. But, you know, it's funny because I think people's perception of comedy now, you know, the culture's changed. And I was watching a stand-up comedian where he's like, you know, he was talking about he made a joke 10 years ago and he's getting flack for that joke now because it was slightly un-PC. But he's saying, like, you know, that they've kind of shifted the goalposts and people can't be kind of giving me shit for something I said 10 years ago, which now isn't acceptable. It was like, you know, I defended Fawlty Towers, for example, because of a certain scene in The Germans that people were all getting up in arms.
Aye.
But, you know, John Cleese came out the next day and he's satirizing something. And, you know, and John Cleese being John Cleese, he says, the reason you don't get the joke is because you're stupid, right? So he was, you know, he was very blunt about it. And this is the thing where opinions are changing now. And I think a lot of people are kind of jumping on a bandwagon, you know, of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And there has to be a bit of wiggle room there, you know?
Aye. I think if you just don't deliberately go out to make a joke at someone else's expense. I mean, the great, great comedians like Billy Connolly and, you know, even like people that took it right to the wire, like Bill Hicks, you know, and Richard Pryor again, and you know, the wonderful world of stand-up that we love, the Chevy Chase, all those great, you know, they didn't ostracize people, or they didn't take the mickey out of anybody vulnerable. I mean, I just don't find jokes funny. Any racial jokes are taking the mickey out of anybody who's got any, you know, disability of any sort whatsoever. I just can't find those people in any way acceptable or funny. And, you know, even, you know, jokes that people have using, you know, use the so-called ignorance of other people to make the joke, you know, look how ignorant those people are. This character is an ignorant character, so that makes it okay for this person to think that that's acceptable. No, I'm sorry, no. Molly Conley never once ever made anybody, you know, less of a person or thought that they could make a joke about somebody. So to me, you know, that's great skill.
Yeah.
And it's great talent, you know. I've no interest really in humor that's satirical on that level, or you know, critical of people that maybe you feel are worth, you know, are joke worthy, you know.
Yeah, well, you mentioned people like Bill Hicks, who, you know, their material has just stood the test of time, and it's as relevant now as it was 25 years ago.
Oh, big you time, know, big time, big
the,
time.
The same with Richard Pryor. You know, that stuff is as fresh today.
He was he could make such racial, you know, paragraphs of hilarious satire about, you know, the black community and the white community and the differences. And it never, ever, you know, he was never racist, but he was just funny, you know, funny and slagging off white people and just in the right tone, you know, to get the point across, but never being racist or derogatory, you know.
Yeah. I think Eddie Murphy had said, though, when he kind of after he kind of burnt himself, I don't even remember that, he poured petrol on himself and lit himself on fire, and, you know, he cleaned up his act and got sober, and Eddie kind of said he was far funnier when he was kind of, you know, taking drugs or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It was almost like he'd lost his edge to a degree. But, I mean, he was a complete innovator, you know. I could still watch that stuff like I'd watched it for the first time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, incredible. Just so funny. Oh, just so funny. In L.A., that one in the pyramid, wasn't it, in Los Angeles in the 70s, when he drives up in the car. It's brilliant.
So
talks about Nick.
Well, speaking of funny, I have to say, you've been in one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's the Peter Serafinovich show.
Oh, I know. He's so great.
There's a sketch where he does the Marlon Brando masterclass and they have him kitted out like Jabba the Hutt.
I just thought,
obviously me being a Star Wars fan, you know, and I thought that was a great show, and it didn't get the traction I think maybe it deserved, you know?
Yeah, I think it was done on YouTube or something, wasn't it? It was sort of... it was for the internet, was it? Or did it go on TV as well?
Yeah, no, we did a whole series for BBC. So that went out, and it was great. It was really, really good, you know?
I think given their own, you know, I think James and Peter, they're amazing writers and comedians, obviously. The brother, his younger brother James, was a producer. So, I just think they should have been just sort of left to do their own devices. I think if it had been now on the internet, you don't really need big networks to sort of make things happen. I think there was quite a lot of, you know, editing around their material, which I think maybe was detrimental to the actual show. But he's incredible, Peter. He's such a talented guy. My God, he's so funny.
He is. He's great. He's great.
You know, they were brilliant. Great crack guy.
And the voice of Darth Maul in Star Wars, which you were in the first one, or the Phantom Menace, should
That's
I say.
Right, guy. That's right, because I met the guy that played Darth Maul.
Is it Ray, and he Ray was Wise? Ray Wise?
He's a martial arts guy.
Yeah.
And he was getting his makeup on, and obviously the red kind of face. And he was like, all right, how's it going? Where are you from? Are you from Darth Maul? And I was all, where are you from? And he was like, from Ermston in Manchester or something like that. All right, how's it going?
Brilliant.
It was Darth Maul.
Oh, man, that's like the Darth Vader, the original footage where it's not James Earl Jones' voice, it's Dave Prowse's voice.
Right.
And he's just got that up north kind of voice, you know, and the dialogue sounds hilarious.
Darth Vader.
I think, you'd said to me, because that scene you're in Phantom Menace is, you've Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson in the back, but when you were shooting your scene, I think you told me it was just like two Jedi capes with a couple of brooms holding it up or something like that.
We all had to go to the left and go to the right as if the spaceship was cracking.
Yeah.
It was cracking. Oh, and I'm there going, that's George Lucas. God, fucking George Lucas, look at me. That's George Lucas. You know.
That's gas. I'm sure everyone asks you about Star Wars all the time. I was just going to ask you, you just finished up season 3 of Brassic.
We just finished Brassic in March there. So kind of incredible to be able to work during this madness.
But I was going to ask you, how has it been different going back to work, you know, with the new restrictions in place and obviously trying to maintain everybody's safety? And, you know, you obviously want to hug, you know, you do work with these people very intensely and you get very close to these people. Was that difficult?
The first 3 months was the sort of September to December was very difficult because we were literally... I wasn't able to fly home and I maybe would have 2 weeks off at a time in between shooting. So I was kind of struggle there, but in the hotel on my own,
yeah,
where there was nothing open and nowhere to go. And I was obviously trying to write, but I wasn't in any way inspired.
Yeah.
To do the music. But I, you know, once I get the first 3 months over me, then I knew what I was dealing with. I was kind of all right. So I'm back in January and things were slightly a little bit more mellow. But, you know, we were very well looked after, Johnny. We had a great COVID unit in place.
Yeah.
And but it was challenging. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But again, we were very appreciative to be in an industry that, that was able to function in such a horrendous year, you know.
Yeah, well, it seems like film and TV has managed to kind of keep some level of momentum going, you know. But unfortunately, the music industry, we will be the last to play again.
I really hope.
You know, in Ireland as well, Brona, like, we're not really kitted out for outdoor culture, you know.
Not at all. We just can't rely on the weather, obviously. You know, there's definitely gigs starting to be sort of rumbling now about coming in. But, I mean, it's all, obviously, the weather rules the day. So I think that, you know, we're probably looking realistically at next year before we can really sort of, you know, think about putting any proper gigs in the place or putting tours again and stuff like that. Yeah. Because this year's just, as you say, it's just too dangerous still, you know.
It is. But, like, there's gigs happening in the UK. I mean, there's the, you know, stuff is kicking off again. I'm hopefully going over there in the winter to do a tour. And but, again, I don't know. Am I able to go and come back? Or, do you know, will I have to? So it's all very, very – it's kind of hard to commit to something if you think, well, if I go to England, I have to sit in a hotel for 2 weeks when I get back. That's certainly –
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, all that. It wasn't worth a while coming back. But, I mean, I don't know if I – would you back this year to do another series of it? But I don't know what the story is, but just, you know, a day at a time, isn't it? The old philosophy, stay in the present, day at a time.
Yeah, so is that – what have you got lined up for the rest of the year then?
Well, we're halfway through, more than halfway through the fourth album now.
Wow.
And obviously we don't want to really release anything when we can't tour, because that's really where people start to get to know the music when you're doing gigs. So, you know, writing away, recording away, working hard on that stuff, and go back and do Brassic. So hopefully by this, the beginning of next year, we'll be in a much clearer position to sort of call the shots on what's happening, you know.
Yeah.
But just still being, you know, being disciplined and creative and, you know, keeping the head down. So that's sort of what the next year, for the rest of this year anyway, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to finish my record and get it out next year.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. You're halfway through it. And so you've got Brassic coming up. Any movies coming up?
Well, everything that was shot has come out. So, I mean, there's no movies. I can't really – I mean, I've had a few you know, a few things bubbling around, but I am I'm definitely doing Brassic from July onwards, so I can't really get involved in anything else, because you can't really be involved in two different productions.
Sure.
This year, you know, obviously because there's traveling involved.
Yeah.
So it's kind of one or the not the other. So I don't mind really sort of that. It'll be probably our last year, I think, at Brassic. So going to go over there again and to Manchester and do that.
Great. And is there anybody because I know I've been talking to you for nearly an hour and a half now, and I don't want to keep you too long, Brona, but in terms of Irish talent, you know, is there anybody you got your eye on right now who you just, because I know your co-star in A Bubble Along the Way, I thought she did a great job.
Oh, Lola's fantastic.
Yeah, she did.
Lola's wonderful and a great career ahead. I have great belief in Lola. I just think there's so many young, fabulous young actors and actresses around, you know, and wonderful bands as well. The Murder Capital.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're a big fan of them. And, you know, really excited for the young bands that, you know, you just hope they get the opportunity to tour their records now when they come out. But there's so much young talent in our show as well. You know, you've got young India Mullen, who's another wonderful young Dublin actress who's playing a new part in Brassic. She's great. And there's just so many, you know, and it's just lovely to see so many young artists that they're just, you know, getting the breaks that they deserve, and the young bands as well. So it's great. You just want to encourage young people to write their own stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
keep you know, keep focusing on that, you know.
Well, it feels very weird to have not played with anyone in a year. You know?
Oh, stop. That's crazy.
Well, I did a couple of TV things. I did The Late Late actually a few months back, and it was just a mime, so it was grand, you know. But I did one of those live stream things, which I was slightly uncomfortable about it, because you're just playing in a room to three cameras, and you kind of you're rocking out and you finish a tune and it's just like tumbleweed, you know, just.
Oh, the weirdest thing. No, because we even spoke about it recently, because we did one, well, when we could legally meet last year, myself and the boys, and we did the Van Morrison tribute for Hot Press, and that went down really, really well. And then the lads said, well, should we not do a stream of our new stuff? And I was just like, do you know what? Because we released the single with Dave Stewart and that went down really well. But
yeah.
I just felt, you know, like that, such an anticlimax when you don't have the audience who are so much part of why you do what you do. So we're just going to wait until we can actually just get out in front of people again, because there's that sense of sort of like there's an emptiness to it, you know, and there's a, you know, there's a real sort of, as you say, anticlimax and a bit of a downer if you can't sort
I felt exactly that way after about a half an hour into this hour long set. I just felt a little bit deflated by it. Do you know what I mean?
I know. And I think it's slightly been, not exhausted. I mean, Jeekers, fair play to anybody that's done it, but I just felt because we're so much about the give and take of the energy back and forth to the audience, I just, I really would miss doing it without people there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I was on an Instagram live thing the other night, and there was a girl who used to go to the Frames gigs, and I was saying things like, you know what I miss? I miss the smile on your face when I'm playing. And
it's huge. It's huge. It's just, you know, it's the two way train track of, you know, energy. It's vital. You can't do it without it, you know.
No.
We are nothing without our audiences, and you know, they're nothing without us, you know.
Yeah. I think maybe I just need my ego massaged a little bit, Brona.
Sounds like it, Johnny. Sounds like it. I know, it's true. It's one of the reasons we do it, and it's just love, isn't it? It's why we do it. Like,
that's exactly what it is. That's exactly. But listen, you're so good to talk to me today. It's funny, you know what? I have all my notes here, Brona, and they're from February last year. You know,
I know that's how long we've been trying to talk. I know,
and you've been so good and patient with kind of just keeping in touch with me, and you know, getting to do this because.
I really wanted to do it. No, I just wish we had nobody sit down, as you say, and do it. But sure, none of us knew a year ago what was in their seats, 13, 14 months ago. How long this is going to last? We thought it was going to just be a couple of weeks. Sure,
I know. But you know, it's funny actually. Even doing this podcast has been massively cathartic because talking to people like yourself, who still remain really active through it, whereas then you've other people that are, you know, they've been really striving to just be creative and stay motivated.
Oh,
and,
no.
You know, because I even just started the podcast last February, and actually the first person I interviewed was actor Jim Bartley, who's a huge fan of yours. And you know, Jim drinks in my local, and I meet him for a pint every now and again, and he'll always regale you with stories every now and again of, you know, working with people like Brenda Fricker and Pierce Brosnan, and he's actually been working in RTE since like the late 50s or early 60s, you know.
Has he?
And he's still working, Brownie. He's 75 now, and he's still at Fair City, you know.
That's incredible. It's just wonderful. It's wonderful. Do you have a steady work as an actor is a blessing, because so many people just, they lose confidence after a while if they're not working. Or it's a blessing to have regular work, you know, because it does. It's a very tough world. It's a very tough life, you know, as any artist does, you know, because there's no guarantees. So if you can get something regular, it's great. Sure, you can just have a nice lifestyle from it.
I think I said that to someone. I said it to a songwriter once. I was like, did you ever consider just packing it in, like, you know, when things weren't going so well? And he was just like, nope. And I kind of felt bad for asking it. You know what I mean? Because I don't think it's something any of us could do, really. I mean, you do see people that do pack it in, but I you know, even for me teaching, the gratification I get from that, you know, mentoring like teenagers.
Absolutely.
I've had some kids come into the house the last few years for lessons, and obviously I had to stop that, you know, but you know, you get a kid 12 years of age and you teach them through their teens, and even just the sense of enthusiasm and even just making them feel good about themselves. Like in that half an hour, they feel like they've achieved something. I get a huge amount of satisfaction out of that. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's like, absolutely. I mean, you're passing on your knowledge and your energy, and you're passing on your skill to somebody. It's wonderful. You know, I think it's great. I think it's very important because I have so many teachers in school that were, like, as I said at the beginning, you know, that encouraged me or encouraged myself and my sister and my brother and obviously my parents, you know, lifelong, you know, in debt to them for their time that they took and the money that they had and the money that they didn't have to put us into drama classes and music classes and, you know, art stuff like that. You know, those they're your signposts in your life, and you know, somebody to believe in you is incredible. You know, so I think you should be very proud of that. You know, because it can just take one person that can just give you that wee confidence and that wee spark to go, well, no, I can do this. You know, because children are obviously so vulnerable, but they're so brave. And they're born without any sort of self-doubt or any self-consciousness. And it's an utter privilege and a gift to be able to pass that on and to give somebody a continued sense of self-belief and that they can actually go and do it. I mean, it, you know, because so many people's dreams are crushed by somebody saying that you're not good enough and they never get to fulfill that life that they maybe have a great talent for, you know. So I think this is the real petrol, isn't it? Giving your talent to somebody else and telling them that they are good enough. You know, that's all we want to hear.
Absolutely. Like I found when I was about 15, I mean, I was gigging when I was 14. I was already playing around Ireland and, you know, got to go to Japan when I was 16, to Tokyo for a week to play some gigs. Right. You know, it was like amazing. But like, there was always a sense I found of, you know, actually you're wasting your time at that little music, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was my dad who encouraged me, and he was very much like, look, take the road less traveled. He would have been all about that, you know. And
absolutely, that's what I mean. And you know, that's fantastic. That's a gift, like,
oh, big time. I wouldn't have been able to, without his encouragement. I wouldn't have become the person I am to a large degree. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You know, that's it, to give you the gift of it. That's extraordinary. And all, you know, we have those people to thank, Johnny.
We certainly do. And it's funny, when I do open days at the college, it's always the big question from the parents: what is there a job after this? That's all, you know. And you can't.
But I mean, you can. You know, I mean, you look at the incredible young bands that have come out of the college in the last few years, and you know, you've Grammy nominated young artists there now, and I'm sure, I know, a plethora more to come, you know.
Absolutely. I've had the drummer from the Fontaines been one of my students, the drummer from the Murder Capital. I mean, you mentioned them earlier. I've seen those guys play, and just the singer reminds me. I don't know, I get a Morrissey vibe off him, but he's got his own thing going on. He's a real intensity about him, you know.
Yeah, he's fantastic, James. I almost Ian Curtis kind of world. David Byrne. I know they're extraordinary. You know, I mean, I think just as long as they can get back out and do their gigs now and rock out and get their albums out there, it's a tough world. You got to keep the head, and the shoulders.
Well, you know, the intensity of being in a band when you're young as well, particularly if you start to get a bit of traction and some success, you know, and you see bands like the Fontaines, and the Murder Cap, they're getting a bit of momentum now. And that kind of momentum has been stifled in this last year. So I'm really hoping those guys get the crack they deserve next year, you know?
Absolutely. Just keep writing. Keep focusing. Keep writing. And get better. Write better.
That's it. Well, look, Rona, you're so good to talk to me.
Johnny, so great to talk to you. Finally. We could talk for Ireland.
I know. And sure, look, it's only the tip of the iceberg talking about, you know. I mean, you've had an amazing career. And, you know, I think the last time we hung out and partied, or, you know, after a gig was I think it was on the Frames tour bus. And was it Cambridge Corn Exchange or? God,
I think it was that night after the university gig.
It could have been. It was one night.
That's around 2006.
Yeah, it was around then. And then
holy moly!
And I think I bumped into you on the street maybe once or twice, but that was about it. You know, so it's been a long.
Would you a hang?
A total hang. Well, I mean, the next time you're playing, I'll be down. I've always.
Yes, please. Sure, listen. We'll let you know that, but hopefully, we'll see you before that, maybe. That might be next year, but sure, I know where you are. I know when he's opened up again, I'm going to say hello.
Thank you.